Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by The Isley Brothers, The Carpenters, The Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
It's an old story from early days. The elements are basic. Beach and sea. Land and air. Storm and sun. Force and counterforce. Proposition and reversal. A place.
Rob Benvey is a gifted author, musician, screenwriter, producer, and songwriter based in Toronto, Ontario. Originally from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Benvey was a member of the band Thrush Hermit, which came of age and also ended its initial run in the 1990s. In his own pursuits, Benvey has played in bands like The Deers, Camouflage Nights, Tigra Benvey, and Bankruptcy, but he's also written 3 novels to date, contributed to esteemed periodicals, and written at least 2 films with his collaborator, Maxwell McCabe-Locos. Benvie's latest novel is 2021's Bleeding Light, a mystical, surreal story of personal exploration and transcendence divided into four interconnected parts. Released by Invisible Publishing on July 6th, 2021, Bleeding Light prompted Rob to return to this show for a discussion about his pandemic life and why he's not a hypochondriac, supernatural phenomena, existentialism, escapism, and social media, fatherhood and daddy issues, succession and William Shakespeare, why the Beatles were unprecedented and the Get Back documentary generally, nostalgia and why Thrush Hermit broke up, the star-studded benefit soundtrack to Bleeding Light, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is the 658th episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Rob Benvie with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
And free us of their curse. No matter. Me? I'm done with old myths. High time to castrate the gatekeepers.
Hey, Rob, how's it going?
Great!
Well, that was very enthusiastic. You're doing really well. That's great.
Very good. Never been better.
No, it's downgrading now. No. I don't know what happened. Where in the world are you? I can see from our video interface that you are potentially trapped somewhere. Where in the world are you today?
Well, define trapped. I'm in my home in beautiful downtown Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Some sort of basement cave type thing, though?
It is. Yes, I'm in my basement. I guess, yeah, you're seeing some rough edges. It's a bit of an unfinished basement.
No, it looks lovely. It looks like probably a house built in the, late 19th, early 20th century, maybe?
That's right. We just moved in here in the summertime, so we're still working on it.
It looks lovely. I miss my old 19th century home in Guelph. Yeah. I have a newfangled
place. It's 21st century?
Place.
Is this,
well, yeah,
is
it it's, smart it's, house? Absolutely. It's is 21st it, century.
Do you do,
yeah.
like, lights on? Like,
no.
Clapper?
No, it's not as fancy as it could be. It could be fancier.
Yeah.
But it is, it's comparably quite fancy and spacious. I have a music room with my drum kit set up, actually, in it. And
that's cool.
So I kind of like it. Things are good. Otherwise, I know as we're speaking, lockdowns have come back and stuff like that. Are you keeping safe? Are you feeling okay?
Yeah. Yes. I'm feeling embarrassingly fine. Almost.
Yeah.
Shamefully fine.
Yeah.
I'm not really a worrier in that kind of, when it comes to that sort of thing. So as long as everyone's, you know, doing I just follow the rules. I do what I'm told. And have faith. Have faith that one way or another, things will turn out. Not for the better, not for the worse.
It's true of you. You're very subservient. Everyone knows that.
I do what I'm told all the time, no matter who's telling me.
In your literary work and in some of your musical work, I sometimes pick up on at least a tinge of dystopia. Does that make you psychologically and emotionally more equipped for actual dystopia when it happens?
I'm going to say no. I'm a sort of maybe whatever the opposite of a hypochondriac is, I'm that. I never worry about, I mean, I'm also been fortunate enough to not have any major health concerns myself. So far. So I kind of don't worry too much about myself getting sick. I worry about, you know, like my kid getting sick and stuff like that a little bit, but the state of the world. And I guess it's, there's one thing to worry about the state of the world in a sort of nebulous, almost sort of poetic sense, and then to actually see it potentially happening. So there's a, you know, it's a different thing. And in the early days of pandemic lockdown, or the sort of, you know, as things were really, really getting serious, I remember having a few days where I was like, is this it? This is really it. This is the thing. This is what's going to bring us down. Like this, I was kind of late to that sort of thinking. I just sort of assumed, oh, this is, I can't believe, you know, I didn't take it quite. Not to say that I didn't take it seriously, but I'm not denying the existence of it. But I was just like, oh, this will blow over, you know. Like I just sort of, because I grew up in the time and place that I did, that I've never really had to face any significant hardship in a meaningful way. So I just sort of, things will blow over, you know. And then they have not. So I don't worry actively, but I just sort of feel we all do what we can, and you know, play by the rules, do your stuff, get vaxxed up, you know, all that stuff. So
I understand not worrying about it on a health level, a personal health level. You're not a hypochondriac, you're not a worrier. But yeah. When I reference dystopia, there's obviously that. Oh, yeah. Like there's the virus, yeah. But what about the attitude and tone of Western civilization as it endures this thing, this collective calamity? Yeah. That's where I'm getting at. Like I know maybe I'm misusing the term dystopia, but it feels like a crumbling of society.
Yeah.
It's not simply the fact that we are literally plagued by something. It's our reaction to it that I find.
Yes.
Frustrating. Yeah, I think. Yeah, frightening. Yeah,
I'm of the mind, like many people, that you know, as the world, when the world, you know, the world is in many ways ending around us, and yet we continue on as if it's not happening. You know, and I do that. I find myself doing that because it's you're not really aware of civilization crumbling when you're within it, when you're fed and housed and like many sort of us in a middle class way of life are, you don't really register it in an active way until it finally hits home, and then it's suddenly, what happened? How did no one see the signs? And it's like, well, the signs have been there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I fully get on board with the premise that COVID is a symptom or a sign of things to come, or an example of how things in our world are just not sustainable, and you know that our habits are catching up to us, way we treat our planet and treat our, you know, treat one another. But yeah, there's so many dimensions to it. It's hard to even get your head around it. It's hard even sort of even right now. Like, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the sort of collision between man and nature? Are we talking about collision between man and man? Or you know, like the powers that be versus those who get stomped on. I mean, and there's so many dimensions to it. And
it's the perfect storm of all of those things colliding, I think. That's where I'm coming from. And I know, Rob, because you've been on the show a few times and we've talked many times.
I'm like your co-host at this point. I'm your Ed McMahon.
The last time you were on the show, we did have a co-host, Pete Elkiss, who kind of stood back, I thought, when I think about it. He was like...
Did he?
A little bit. I Pete's maybe. So funny, and he was so great, but it was his idea to have us all together, too, which was good. I miss him. Can we get him on this call? We should get Pete on. He'll brighten the mood.
He probably would. He calls me a lot during the day when he's bored. He likes to he'll call me and when he has nothing to do, I guess. Maybe I don't know if I'm the antidote to his boredom or a part of it. I don't know. But he's been known to call me up.
In any case,
driving around.
What I was getting at there is we've had a few conversations. I think I've conveyed my admiration for the way you think about things incisively, intellectually. So before we get into a discussion about, and I'm going to hold it up for you like we're on a TV talk show and I'm showing the folks at home. I've got a copy of Rob's latest novel, Bleeding Light, which is really wonderful, but also it messes with my mind a little bit, and we'll talk about that a little. But maybe going a little bit out of order, we've been talking a little bit about the current state of affairs. This book, I assume, was written... Well, let me establish that first. This book was written and finalized prior to the pandemic, correct?
It was, yeah. Yes, it was.
So let me jump into more of a present question, I guess, before we get into the past with your writing of this book. Have you been writing since the pandemic occurred? And has any of these modern times, has it infiltrated your writing at this point?
I guess a little hard to say. I am writing a lot these days. I finished another manuscript a little while ago that I've been sort of trying to get some oomph happening behind and maybe getting that out and a few other things. Yeah, I'm kind of always working on things. It has infiltrated both in kind of a, you know, indirect way and a couple times in a direct way. I mean, you know, if you're writing about our current contemporary moment, you have to make an active choice. Like, do we ignore this, you know, thing all around us, you know, just on a surface level of wearing masks or just the kind of general temperature of the society right now. You know, do you take that into account or do you pretend like it's not happening? I had to sort of even think about that when Bleeding Light was sort of in the later editing stages, like, because it was written in fits and starts over a while, a couple of things of, it's not an overtly political book, but there's a couple of things that I had to sort of like question myself, like, when does this exactly, is this taking place? Is, are we in Trump world or not in this novel? And a couple, I changed a few things to sort of make it yes and no, you know, a little less precisely nailed down in time and space, but, or in time, space, it's nailed down. But in terms of pandemic stuff influence, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think it's yet to be seen. I mean, it's such a monstrous global thing that's happening. And, you know, certainly the effects of it are going to play out for a long, long time. And I mean, they're still ongoing and no end in sight, really. But in me personally, I would say yes, only in that I like to think actively about what is going on with us right now. And by us, you know, obviously I'm in a very loose term. I'm not speaking on behalf of every single person on the planet. But what is going on to... in the context of what I'm writing about socially and dimensionally in that regard. But in terms of like really have anything wise or insightful to say about the pandemic, I don't think I do, at least not yet. I mean, I don't think I have any insights that are going to, you know, blow anyone's mind in terms of like what it all means or what it all does to us. You know, lots of people are trying to figure that out and, you know, to varying degrees, succeeding and failing. But, you know, we rely on our own experience to kind of come up with our conclusions or non-conclusions, and that's what I'm doing, I guess.
When you do write about something, when you have an idea in mind that might be inspired by something that is going on societally or personally, when you do write, does it ever help clarify something for you? I do believe that sometimes when you write stuff down, we always say that to our kids. You know, if something's happening and you don't like it, just write down what you feel. I mean, it's like journal keeping or keeping a diary. Just write it down. Maybe that'll help you organize your thoughts or at least take it out of your brain or whatever. But do you find that? Does it help you when you write to understand something more clearly?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, describe writing or specifically like fiction writing as it doesn't really work very well as therapy. And books that are written as like a therapeutic exercise for the author, I think generally turn out badly. But, you know, if I had to, I could, you know, of the three novels I published, each one kind of relates to specific issues I was having or at least thinking about in my own personal life and psyche and, you know, emotional state. But that's more sort of background, I think, or like at least, you know, but I mean, that's one way to ensure that you maintain enthusiasm for working on something. Like writing a novel, you know, it takes a long time and you have to maintain, you know, a personal engagement with the material yourself to just be enthusiastic and excited about it. So while you shouldn't use that as an opportunity to like work out your demons necessarily, those demons can kind of push you on to do better work, if that makes any sense. So it's not like, not like anything. I'm not really a big fan of that. Yeah, like something that's overtly confessional, but it seeps its way in because I, you know, write about people and their feelings and their states of mind. So
yeah,
it happens.
Yeah, no, I do. I can't help but feel that when even in a work of fiction, these characters that you write are some extension of you as a person, or your understanding of people, or your fantastical notion of people. Even like that's all come.
Yeah.
It's obviously all coming from stuff that's within you as the creator. So just to catch people up and to maybe give some people some insight about what Bleeding Light is all about.
Everyone's read it.
Everyone, it has been out a while.
Everyone.
Sorry for the delay in getting to getting you on the show to talk about it there, Rob. I know it's been out. It's been out what, since the summer or something, or the fall?
It came out in, when did it come out? July.
Yeah, yeah. I started reading it in the summer, but then had to read other things. So I put it. I picked it up and I put it down and I brought it to a cottage. Even like I read it as much as I could, and then it kind of came to me in fits and starts. But I will tell you, Professor, that I finished the book and I enjoyed it. And so, but for the people who haven't yet read it, so I appreciate that millions and millions of people have read it already. But for those who haven't, can you, in your own words, characterize this book, summarize it, so to speak? Because it's a It's a fascinating structure in itself, but can you give people a little taste of it?
Well, it is a novel in four distinct sections that have four interwoven stories, all kind of to varying degrees talking about people's experiences with, I like the word, otherworldly phenomena. So that takes upon, you know, encounters with unexplainable celestial phenomena, as well as, you know, a certain degree, supernatural entities, but also, you know, religion and ghosts and memories and visions. But it's in a contemporary context, and it's kind of straddles many different places all over the world. That's a very broad way of putting it, but it kind of, I don't know, without getting into the nuts and bolts of like the actual plot, I mean, it's four distinct sections, but it's not really like one of those like crappy movies from like the early 2000s where like everything's connected and that's the song.
You mentioned that it interweaves, and I can see that and feel that on occasion, but it's not, as you say, it's not an overt interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's connections. I mean, the four sort of distinct stories are linked by relations between the characters in the novel, as well as kind of structural and symbolic links between them. But it is a novel. It's not four stories.
Yeah, I think that's what some people might think as they get into it, but they are connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think of it as the book I always refer to as The Sound and the Fury, if you've read that.
Right.
Like, that was the...
I haven't read that since university days, but well, yeah, I've read it.
Yeah, you've read it.
If my professor from 1997 asks, I definitely read that book and wrote an essay about it. I picked up on that. So in terms of these, I guess, mystical or otherworldly ideas, do you have
I choose my words carefully because I don't want it to sound like something it's not, and that's not to when it's hard to, when you're describing fiction, you know, there's all these sort of categorical and genre distinctions that people like to make, and I'm not like a person who necessarily cares about that, but just in terms of like explaining it to somebody who does not know the book, they always like, what genre is it, you know, and I'm like, I don't know.
Well, you've got characters that I think are like all of us are, particularly these days, you know, really struggling to figure out the meaning of things, life. Yeah. and also maybe their interrelations. Actually, there's a section here that seems to dovetail a little bit with... Have you been following this television program, Succession?
I have, yes.
There's at least one part of the book where I get a Succession vibe.
You mean like the father?
Yeah,
character?
There's something going on in that last section, I believe it is, right, with the arms cap?
Yeah, well, that kind of, you know, for this autobiography-driven elements, you know, for those of us out there who have father issues like myself, this is in your wheelhouse if you want to read about people with daddy issues.
I'm sorry to hear that you have father issues. Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah. I had a father. I am a father.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave it at that unless you want to delve into it further. Is that dynamic, I guess, then drawn between the father and the son? For those who haven't seen it gets a little Shakespearean. Read it, rather.
It gets a little Shakespearean. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
so, yeah, it gets a little Shakespearean. Yeah. A little Oedipal. You know, I mean, well, we all have, I mean, parent-child relations, you know, those are stories as old as time. You know, it's hard to get away from that stuff. We are of what we came from, so that's... And, you know, one thing about this book is that I liked to take those kind of archetypal, you know, sort of timeless tropes and just really blow them up and, like, not shy away from them. And so there's a lot of classic, as you said, Shakespearean sort of dynamics between some of the characters in terms of parental or authority figures and cosmic relations in that regard.
Well, you create some characters that are both, or all rather, damaged, and some of them are complete assholes too. And so when I brought up Succession, you know, the first section, I'm like, I'm not saying you were influenced by Succession, but I've been obsessed with it as well. And so you're like, well, this guy's clearly the Roman character. This guy's clearly the Kendall character. Okay. Like there's types of people that are damaged by their upbringing or whatever society has presented them with. And each of these characters represents some, I don't know, disappointment in life, I guess is a way to put it. And you know, knowing you as much as I do, like, for example, one of the sections, the action takes place in India. And if memory serves, didn't you live in India for a while? Like, did you spend time there?
I visited there. My then girlfriend, now wife, lived there for a while, and so I went there to stay with her. Yeah, so that was directly influenced by the time. I wasn't there all that long. I was only there for like a few months.
A few months in India is like a long time. I was there for 6 weeks in 1989, and I'm still thinking about it.
Yeah, it left an impact on me for sure.
Yeah,
it's something.
It's
quite a place, and and I was, you know, obviously quite a fish out of water there. So yeah, that's in the book. That was definitely, those experiences that people have in India are ones that I had.
In
a pretty direct way. So, but yeah, the Succession thing. I mean, I wish that show is very, very smart and very. I mean, I have nothing to say about the show that hasn't been said a million times. Everyone knows it's great, but it's very unflinching and it's very bold, and those are sort of things I aspire to. But I mean, it's like uproariously funny too. So,
well, I think you go for that a little bit as well. Of course, I mean,
I like that. Thank you for saying that. I go for it being funny. I'm not actually funny, but I go. That's my thing, Vish. I know. I'm not actually a funny guy, but I make an attempt. You know. So I mean, you know, it's in the trying.
Every funny person attempts to be funny. This was not meant to. This is not the section of our interview where
is that true? You say that like as if it's something that's like inarguably true, that people who are funny try to be funny. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think so. If you're funny, you're trying to be funny, and then you could be naturally funny.
What about people who are funny without trying?
Well, those are
I'm just pushing
those
back.
Are like your parents. If you're lucky, they just do strange things, or you're. My daughter, I'll show you. Here, look at this. My daughter, for my birthday, made me this. No one else can see this, but I'll describe it to you.
Oh, that's a good...
So, Rob, you describe it. What do you see here? What's going on in this image?
I think what I see is a banana with a face and arms and legs gesticulating to a basketball. And the basketball seems to be puzzled because it has a question mark hovering above its head.
And there's two more question marks down at the bottom.
There's presents... there's some gifts, I think, with question marks around.
Yeah,
so there's a mystery. It's a mystery of something is being conveyed of mystery and uncertainty.
Well, then she also
banana and a basketball.
She also gave me this card, which is nice. But this was for my birthday, and look what does the inscription say?
Merry Christmas, Papa. Good handwriting, good penmanship.
When I asked why, she said I forgot what the day was for. Because it was my birthday present. And then she also wrote, ha ha ho, I don't know what it says. Ha 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 ha, ho 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 ho, Papa. It's like getting messages from the Joker and the Riddler. And I think
I was going to say, it's very Batman.
Yeah, so there's just like, anyway, that leads me back to Succession.
Is the banana and the basketball some sort of clue?
Well, I love bananas, and I love basketball, so that's what she was going for. And I often try to tell my kids that despite all the sugar, bananas are good for you in the morning, and you should eat a banana, and it's slowly catching on. And we also have a running, tell me if you think this is bad, every morning when we walk the kids to school, I eat a banana as I go, and we get to this specific bush, shrubbery, and I throw the banana peel under to nourish the bush, but... They worry that it's littering, and I say no, it's going to help. So this has become a running thing with my daughter. That's all. Mm. That's all I was getting at there.
How old your daughter?
You
don't have to talk about your.
I can do it. It's fine. She just turned 7, and the other child is 10. So they're in that age where they think their father is. They're essentializing me to being a banana and basketball man. And that's who I am.
My daughter's latest thing is this is a fun phase where she says, "I love mommy and I hate daddy." That's a fun phase that she's in right now. Makes me feel pretty good.
I feel that they don't say that to me, obviously, because that would be.
She also says she loves me all the time too, but she like thinks she tells me she hates me and then laughs her ass off. And I'm trying to tell her that's a really mean thing to tell somebody, even your father, who's usually the butt of the jokes around the household.
Well, you're not a worrier, you said, but these kids are very perceptive. They pick up on your weaknesses.
Mm.
And I think my daughter does the same. She clings to her mom. And I mean, it says something about me. I'm also the bad cop. I'm the one saying, all right, turn off the TV, brush your teeth, floss, go to bed. Like, I'm that guy more because I know how time works. And I know what time it is all the time. But I also feel like, well, I mean, this is on the school nights. Anyway, I'm just trying to say, like, I don't know about you, but I'm trying not to make the same mistakes that I thought my parents made with me. And sometimes I still make them. And I lose consciousness of the fact that or cognizance of the fact that I'm even doing it. And so my wife will be like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's what my parents did to me. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to do that. So you must be, are you going through that a little bit as someone with, as you said earlier, some dad issues?
Yeah, we rely on our own experiences and I'll often there's umpteen zillion things every day to sort of make a small decision on with kids and often the decision is like, is this something I need to think about or is this something I'm going to let go? And then you rely on your own experience, like, well, when I was a kid, and I'm like, yeah, I try to not, you know, were things good when I was a kid? I don't know. Some aspects of my childhood were great. I mean, I had a rotten father and a great mom, so I hopefully bring together the good from one and none of the other. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, whatever. I try to learn from the lessons of which has come before me, but. Yeah.
Well, it's a
dad podcast. No, it's a dad podcast.
It's always a dad podcast. I'm involved. No, but there are like the misanthropic aspects of some of these characters. I think must be drawn from some aspect of maybe your life.
My own misanthropy.
Yeah. Do you have that? Because you seem like a jolly fun. If I might say, and I'm just going to course correct from earlier. You're a jolly, very funny guy. I know you appreciate the humor. Well, you're funny. it's also the Christmas season, so I can't help but think of you as my own Santa Claus. What? That didn't make any sense. My point is, this misanthropic nature of some of your characters, that is also a part of you. I know this, too. Is that fair?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I would get on board here. I mean, misanthropy is kind of an odd thing. It's a term that people throw around a lot. And, I don't know if I characterize myself necessarily as a misanthrope as a blanket philosophy or a blanket descriptor for how I see people. But, I mean, there's a lot to dislike and a lot to hate about humanity and a lot of bad people and a lot of shitheads out there. So, you know, it's easy to get consumed by that and to let that, you know, stifle potentially some of the greater things of people. But I don't know. I mean, it depends. Honestly, it really depends on which hour of the day you ask me. Right now, we're just two guys chatting over a computer, so I'm feeling pretty good. I'm talking about myself, so that makes me feel good.
Yeah.
certainly misanthropy and disillusionment and, you know, these kind of a very negative view of the world is something that that's kind of motors some of my favorite fiction and my favorite, you know, stories. And so that's kind of my terrain in some regard. I mean, I think it's usually more characters who are, disillusioned or confused or lost within themselves.
You know?
And I certainly have been and am often that way myself. You know, self-doubt, not in doubt as, I mean, like doubt as to your abilities or something, but doubt as in like, what kind of person am I meant to be? How should I be behaving? What should I be doing? Am I a good person? Am I on the right track? Am I, you know, I mean, that stuff nags at you. I don't mean you, but maybe it does you, but nags at one all the time. You know, if you're any kind of self-conscious, self-interrogating person, you just think like, what do I believe in? Am I acting on those beliefs, you know, is the way I behave the way I'd like to be? Am I the kind of person that I'd want to be? And on a small scale, like, am I a nice guy? Am I considerate? Mm-hmm. And on a greater scale, like, am I, you know, in the story of this, you know, universe, am I a hero or a villain? And, you know, or does that even make sense? Is that even something one should even be thinking about? I mean, those kind of big scale questions, you know, seep their way into the stuff I write.
Are you someone who has any particular fascination with excess or extreme behavior or extreme, like, yeah, just extreme behavior? There are some characters, like, I sometimes think that I don't know enough about your youth. I have to get a case file from your whatever. So
what are you talking about? You know everything. You know my youth was being in Thresher.
Yeah, that's true, and that can.
Well, I mean, that's like most of my youth.
Yeah, I guess I know a fair amount about that stuff. But generally, like, I think of some of the characters in this book and the limits they push themselves to, or the limits they want to explore. I imagine this might be vicarious for you to explore the extremes of a human exploration through your characters. But are you yourself fascinated by that stuff?
What do you mean by extremes? Like, are we talking about, like, jumping out of a helicopter with a snowboard on your feet? Or do you mean, like, doing drugs or, like, being violent? Or what do you mean by
extremes?
There's
a certain part of reveling in extremism of any kind, which is kind of escaping from reality. And when I think of the kind of spiritual and, I don't know, there's a lot of angst-ridden stuff in this book. The characters all seem to be like, what the hell is going on? And they are all immersed, as you say, it's an interconnected story, and they're all kind of immersed or confront some sort of phenomena. And it kind of makes them, unsettles them, and then it settles us as the reader. But it also, I think it gives them an entry point into escaping their kind of what they might view as an aimless reality.
Right.
So I'm trying to get to the philosophical aspect of it, I guess, without sounding like a wank. But I do think there's...
Well, there's... I think I do, and I really need to qualify this, but like I do have that desire for transcendence, you know, that desire to sort of find more out of what we're given than is right in front of me, you know, like that restlessness, that yearning, that boredom, that disappointment is there. Again, it's like it's a kind of multi-dimensional thing. It kind of shifts as to what it really means. You know, sometimes you're just bored because you're genuinely bored. And sometimes you feel sort of certain words I take caution using, like when using a word like spiritual self, you know, because who knows what that means. But what you feel that your spiritual self or emotional self is desires more than what you've been given, that, you know, this daily life that we slog our way through, maybe there has to be more than this, you know, that feeling that's built into most of us, that, you know, that there's got to be something up there that offers more to me than just, you know, eating breakfast every day.
Well, but don't you think that the rise of the phone stuff and social media, if you will, and just like the fact that you could be sitting in front of your loved ones at the table at the kitchen, and by the way, this is actually a common issue with someone in my house where I'm like, hey, you got to put the first it was the kids, right. I was like, no devices or TV or screens at the phone at the table rather. Mm-hmm. But now my wife is often on it. And so, and I know it's stressful. It's a weird time. The phone, I think what's happening with the phones is escapism and a feeling like the present moment is not doing it for me. So I'm going to go on to the web. I'm going to go on to the World Wide Web and see what's going on there. Do you see a parallel between that, that behavior in terms of people just looking to any... you talked about drugs.
Yeah.
People often use drugs and escape and alcohol and all sorts of ways to alter their state so they're not having to deal with what's in front of them. And I feel like the phones and the immersion in it is the same. I don't want to be one of those people that's like social media and the technology is a drug, but I think it actually might be. I think it serves the same purpose of like, I'm not happy in this moment, so I'm going to escape into this little box. Sorry. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. It makes too much sense. I mean, like you're saying, I don't want to be one of those people who's like, you know, that stuff is like, it's kind of banal and, you know, tiresome to hear. Social media is killing us forever, because I don't think it's killing us, but it could bring out tendencies in us that are not so great. I've tried out all that stuff and mostly exercised it from my life.
Yeah, you're not on you're not on stuff anymore. I think you were used to be on Instagram and stuff. You're not on there.
Yeah, I've been on all that stuff. I've been on all that stuff in various degrees over the years and tried it out. Because I mean, I'm not a Luddite. Like, I like technology. I like the internet. I try everything.
Well, the
out.
Social aspect of connecting to each other, I think, appeals to you probably on some level.
On some level, but then I think It creates what it really does is create a lot of like religion or like drugs. It creates this sort of false hope. You know, it creates this feeling that it's going to provide something I want, and you know, on occasion it does. You know, it's not the social media and that stuff is not useless. Obviously, you can think of examples where like political causes or something have used things, and I've learned things or you know, been made aware of defects in my thinking from stuff I've read on Twitter or mm-hmm. something in my life. So it's not without its use, but I think to support you in when you are feeling lonely and insecure, it creates a false hope that I think is really not provided. Yeah. You know, I know people who've, you know, like from the stuff, you know, that sort of like fear of missing out feeling gets so intense and or like many people, I often think like, oh, my quote unquote career is not where I want it to be. And then you go on and you know somebody and some assholes like, you know, just sold a TV pilot or something. I'm like, and I'm like, fuck that person. Then I'm in a lousy mood all day, you know? And, yeah. you know, we all have those moments of sort of jealousy or envy or insecurity. And it just amplifies it so much in your mind, especially when you have this sort of like uncertainty feeling, you know? And I just think those, that element of it is just really destructive. And it, and for someone like myself, whose levels of, you know, self-esteem are extremely high, extremely low, all the time on an hourly basis, it just creates a kind of flux that
yeah, absolutely,
not really good in it, and it makes my mind a little manic, and that's the kind of thinking is not good for your mental health, but also not for being productive, certainly not good for writing. But so I'm not against that stuff. Certain people use it well, some people don't. And the other thing is all this. I was on Facebook back in the day, and then I was on Twitter for a while, and then I was on Instagram, and all those things long enough that I could empirically look at it and say, has this made my life better? And is it helping me in any way? And it always, the answer is no. And the things I like about it, like, oh, just putting a joke on Instagram that I think is funny and then no one thinks it's funny. And I'm like, oh, well, that was a waste of energy. You know, like,
that's the hardest part. You get all worked up about an idea you think is good. Almost like a stand-up comedian trying a joke. Whether you're making a joke or not. Whether you're just trying to make some sort of profound, serious statement or a joke, and you put it up, and then there's no, like you say, it doesn't resonate, and you instantly, so you've wasted the time ostensibly coming up with the idea, and then now you're wasting time lamenting that you did it and that it wasn't.
Yeah.
So I get it. It's a couple of hours of your life that is wasted mental energy.
And then you really start thinking, I've found myself thinking that, like, that you have fans. Like, I've started, like, found myself thinking, oh, like, people are really going to dig this hilarious fucking screenshot or something that I've posted. And, like, and then, you know, silence or, like, three people or my sister, you know. And I'm like, wow, where's my fan base? Where's my online fan base? And I'm like, no, it's just my friends. And they don't care. Everyone knows that I'm not funny or they don't care. They just, you know, so it's like, empirically, I can look at it and go, this is a waste of time. I'd rather be doing something else. That said, I have, you know, like, made like SoundCloud accounts under many different names and put up stupid like beats and things in anonymously. And I sort of find that a little more fun to do things like secretly and just, if, you know, some dude from Korea is like, hey, sick beats, man. And I'm like, okay, that's worth way more to me than likes.
Yeah, we got to get over all this external. It's weird because you don't want to be a sociopath. You want to be sensitive to other people's reactions to your being. But at the same time, we are also creating this sort of insularity of like, I don't care if you think it's good or funny or true. What I think is all that matters. So it's very complicated. It's a complicated knot of assertion and defensiveness and self-defensiveness. And it's a bizarre knot.
It's pretty rare that kind of stuff brings out the best of people's personalities. Yeah. You know, like it doesn't always bring out the worst, but I can't think of examples where I'm like, oh, that person really shines on Instagram. Like,
yeah. No.
Every now and then, some people, I mean, there's things that are funny. Like I'm all for a good lol, but I don't really like being on my phone very much. I try to avoid as much as possible. So, you know, so I'd rather, but that escapism, I mean, I do that. I mean, I watch like way too many movies. That's my escape. And like I probably do too much of that.
Well, I will say like
looking at butterflies,
becoming sort of internet literate, whatever that means, or at least consuming things online in a kind of dehumanized, desensitized way. I wonder if it's actually coloring the way I read a book like yours, because within the context of your book, sure. You can see how life life, your one's life and other lives are either valued or completely devalued and dismissed. And it's kind of bizarre when life hangs in the balance in your novel and the characters are just like, well, whatever, you know. So like you get to this, there's something going on there in within the action of your book where I think the meaning of life in all the, I get that that's a cliche, but in sort of pondering what the meaning of one's life is, you can actually begin to devalue other lives selfishly. And I feel like some of that is really coming through in your novel, which I think is maybe born of a time where that kind of attitude of devaluing others or not valuing them, whatever you want to say, I feel like that's really heightened these days. And so I feel like your novel kind of speaks to that on some level. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think so, if I follow your thinking on that. I mean, I very consciously, in the making of that, this novel, wanted to provide some kind of answer to the questions that I was posing, you know, these sort of vague questions about like what, you know, who are we as these atomized units in a sort of postmodern world, and we're spread all over the world and we're connected and we're not connected, and we live in this, you know, especially sort of Western society, like this like hyper individualism driven world, you know, like it's all about the self-gratification, self-worth, self-analysis, self-elevation, you know, everything we're sold and told is about, you know, you are great, find yourself, be yourself. And that really does come at the expense of like, what does it mean to be a person and live in sort of in a society and have some kind of fabric joining us, you know, and I don't mean to be so like, you know, airy-fairy about it, but like, if you're looking for any kind of meaning of, you know, to our lives, you're not going to find it by just thinking about yourself. You know, it's just, that's something I strongly believe. Now that can be interpreted in a million different ways. But so when I was looking at the characters in this book, and they're all very isolated and alone and hoping that the answers to their inner yearning, especially like the character in the first section, is going to come from some kind of confirmation from above. You know, they're going to get a sign. The clouds are going to part. The light is going to shine. And suddenly they're going to be told, you are good. You are meaningful. You know, like, and spoiler, it doesn't happen. But something does happen. Things do happen in the novel that I think illustrate, and it's not really that kind of book that things will be spoiled, but the things that provide a better version of that are when people come together. You know, like the answer that maybe the gateway to the heavens or the cosmos or the, you know, another spiritual realm isn't a pathway to somewhere else. It's just going to take you back to yourself and to your fellow man, you know?
Yeah.
That's, you know, and, you know, that's, I guess it's a little bit of a atheistic argument or something. I don't really like to get into that whole squabble of like, you know, I find sort of contemporary atheistic thinking really irritating and petty.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think the answers to the questions that are plaguing us, I keep using this us, but you get what I'm getting at with us.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm talking about us, you know, like I don't mean to be like so kind of chauvinistic in a certain way, but the society that I'm a product of.
You're not talking about, just to clarify, you're not talking about the periodical Us Weekly. You're talking about us as a human race, if you will.
Yes, that's what I'm
saying. Yeah. Okay.
Human, just making sure. Race. Yeah. The race. And the human race.
Not the animals. The animals are not part of this collective consciousness.
I would never. I'm perfectly comfortable speaking on behalf of the entire human race, but animals, I can't vouch for them. Who knows what they have going on?
They have their own pulpits. They have their own newsletters, I'm sure. They get together.
Yeah.
They talk.
They got issues. Yeah, for sure. but whatever they are, I am not going to chime in on that. But anything at all having to do with all people on the planet Earth, I will speak on behalf of them.
You know, it's funny, as we search for meaning within ourselves and within, you know, how we function in the world, I think some of us can't help but be drawn to our pasts to kind of figure out where we came from. I think in the conversations you and I have had about things like Thrush Hermit reuniting, I've gotten the vibe from you that you're not particularly a fan of nostalgia or looking back too much. Is that still fair to say?
Yeah, well, it depends on when you ask me. I think you're mostly basing that on because when Thrush Hammer did a reunion tour 2 years ago now, and we spoke about it, I didn't really want to talk about it, do an interview about it. But I think we got past that. It was maybe there was some friction there, but it's only.
I think we've talked about it a few different times, though, and I think you've addressed the fact that nostalgia is not potentially a nutrient-rich place for someone to function in.
Yeah, I mean, I fall into it like anyone else. Sometimes, you know, I'll hear a song or something from that I did like years ago, and be like, "Oh, I forgot about that one. That's really funny," or you know, and that sort of tickles a certain nerve. That's fun, but there's no glory in the reliving past glories. But that's not to say that I'm not proud of stuff I've done. But I try to keep it in perspective, you know.
Yeah, no, that's fair. You want to be forward thinking, but I do think that when some characters like the ones in this book, or when you talk about your own upbringing and pondering it, it's not nostalgia, but it's at least processing your past and trying to figure out how you got there, and then And that can dictate your way forward. It's like you're drawing from a behavioral and psychological pattern one way or the other, I guess, whether it's good or bad. And but you have to also recognize, I guess, that you can alter your course. Like you can, you're not married to the past.
Yeah, I'm a very strong believer that I used to very actively think people could not change, that people were sort of doomed to the way we are, and everything's kind of coded into us, and we just live out who we are, and I very strongly feel the opposite.
Yeah,
you know, I think we do have power to change our ways, but it can be a lot of work. It can be very difficult to change our ways, and so how that ties into nostalgia, I'm not really sure. I mean, but I try to I'm just trying to like looking at those sort of things, trying to place them in a certain perspective, especially when it comes to music, because it's like, you know, I've done some things that have found an audience, and a lot of things that have not, and the stuff that people have latched onto is rarely the stuff that I love the most, you know? So
it's weird. We the other thing we do as consumers is we really like the first thing that someone did.
Yeah.
And then,
I was talking to somebody about that with Rick Rubin the other day.
Yeah.
The producer Rick Rubin, who I love a lot of stuff he's been involved in. Certainly all of the Red Hot Chili Peppers albums are incredible.
I assume you're joking for some reason. I don't know.
I don't know. I don't even know anymore. But his whole thing is just like, do what you did on your second record. You know, like every band that comes in, do what you did on your second. Your second record is the best one.
Well, he's certainly done that with like some of the older artists he's worked with. Like, let's get back to your core, which is basically him being like, I don't want to hire a band for these sessions. Can you just play an acoustic guitar by that microphone and talk, and we'll figure it out later?
Yeah. And I may or may not be there.
Yeah.
But I mean, we all do that. I mean, like, the first album was the best. But, I mean, there's reasons for that. A lot of time, especially in music, I mean, you know, the first stuff you do is just you're most energetic and you're frothing at the bit and you can't wait to get out there. And it is a shame sometimes as someone who is, you know, getting older, like, you feel you've gotten better at what you do, but by that time no one cares anymore because there's, you know, you sort of missed your moment when you were younger. In terms of just getting an audience.
No, well, but I do feel like fans are weird. They dehumanize the people in their band. You know that thing where, like, if a band reunites but it's not the original membership, like, someone can't make it? Yeah. You kind of feel like, did I see the band? Because we all recognize the bands have literally, like, there's no doubt about it. Like, three, four people on stage develop a chemistry. And so you're really responding to that, but it's also a little bizarre that when Thrush Hermit says they're going to do a tour, for example, odds are the venues will all sell out. But if Ian McGettigan or Rob Benvie is playing the same venue, it might be a little tougher sell. And you're the people in the band. Like, for me, I'm always like, I'm very loyal if I like a band. Like, I went to go see Joe Lally of Fugazi play once at the Drake. And, you know, there weren't that many. I was surprised that there weren't that many people there. Yeah. It was all kind of older punks like me hanging out, but it wasn't that many people. And meanwhile, of course, if the brand name that everyone knows had been there, they would have had to do 7 nights at that venue, you know? So it's very weird.
Well, I mean, being a fan of music and being a consumer of music, and I don't know if I even think of myself as a fan of music or not, but if you did that Thrush Hermit tour as an example, I mean, we were fully aware that You know, more people came out to see us on that last tour than ever did when we were around. There's reasons for that. I mean, time, and we all got older, and also Joel Plaskett in the band has, you know, he's kept things going, and he sort of picked up where the Freshman left off, and so he took the baton and ran with it, and he has a good following of his own.
Yeah.
But people weren't going necessarily, they were going to see us, but they're really going to see themselves 20 years ago. Like,
yeah.
And that's cool. I mean, it just, as long as you keep that in mind and don't get a swelled head. I mean, music, so much of music is a social thing too. And as you get older and you have families and jobs and stuff, you don't go out as much and you don't see people at shows. I mean, that used to be my life. I would go out to see shows. Like when I was younger and living in Halifax, that's all my friends were in bands, and a band would play, and everyone you knew went, and you went and partied, and you know, that was great. And that sort of thing doesn't exist as much for us as we get a little older. And you know, people sort of sometimes forget how big a component that is to your life as a music enjoyer. You know, it's the social thing. And
I think, but it's kind of any art though can transport you to a time. Like, it's weird. Like if I remember the first time I slapped on a Thresh Hermit record, which would have been after I'd seen you guys actually in the mid 90s, but it's interesting. People are constantly, I think, chasing that spark, that light, to tie into your book. Like, they're going back to that light and that feeling that occurred, like, to illuminate something for them, and they're just constantly chasing it with every... If someone's like, you got to check out this new band, I think for some of us, you're like, will this make me feel the way Thresh Hermit or a band I loved when I was younger will make me feel? Will it elicit the same emotional response? Like, it's a bit weird.
Yeah, it is weird. I mean, and it works on the opposite end too, if I follow your thinking there. I mean, and maybe that was one of the reasons I was really reluctant to publicize those tours as much, and a little reluctant to begin to do them, because certainly those were, you know, I loved playing with those guys, and it's the formative years of my life, and it was, you know, probably when my obituary is written, that'll be the thing that's in it, which I'm fine with. But it wasn't all awesome all the years we were together. I mean, we were together since we were from when, like, Joel Plaskett and Ian McGettigan and I played since we were little kids into our late 20s. And, you know, those are formative times, meaningful times. We did a lot, you know, we got signed, toured all over the place, you know, had all these adventures. But it wasn't, like, amazing the whole time. A lot of time I was, you know, we were pissing at each other, and, you know, not a lot of time, but enough that there's that aspect of it. So when going back, doing the nostalgia thing, it's not, nostalgic has this kind of darker side to it. It's like, oh, do I want to relive this potentially sort of traumatic, you know, thing? I mean, the trauma of being in a rock and roll band is, you know, obviously not equivalent to, like, severe
no,
trauma.
But I get it. You're not just reliving the joy that we all experience. You're reliving the pain.
Yeah, I mean, and to be, like, fully forthright about it, I mean, like, the reason Thresh Hermit broke up was because I was just sick of Joel. Like, I was just could not handle him anymore. Like, he just drove me insane. And I didn't. And but over the years, we're very good friends now, and we remain friends. But it took me a while to just even be able to, like, listen to him, you know. And but by the time, certainly that's, like, long water on the bridge. I love the guy. But getting back together and playing with those guys, you know, there's a certain element of, like, oh, am I going to get, like, back to that? And I don't like, and it was not all on him. A lot of it was me. I was young and
of course.
I had all kinds of rage issues. Well, not rage issues, but, you know, whatever, insecurities. And I was like, I feel better about myself now. We're all better. We're more grown up. You know, we're pals. Are we going to go back to a place that's like that? I mean, even when we did that, that tour, the first rehearsal, there was a tiny little argument about, like, what guitar I was using. And I just felt like this adrenaline rage of, like, this is why I hate these guys. They're always telling me what, like, because I always felt that they were ganging up on me. That was the old thing. Like, I was, so I was like, they're doing it again. I can't believe it. You know, of course, it was all silly, and, like, we got past it in 5 seconds, but is why I didn't want to do the tour, because they're just going to gang up me the whole time, and I'm going to get, you know.
So you're basically George Harrison in this scenario. We all have seen the Get Back movie now.
I have seen that. I'm kind of embarrassed that I watched that, to be honest.
Why?
Because it's such a cliche. The watching of it is, like, I knew it when it came out. I was like, Every person I know is going to watch that, and I just felt like I'm, like, a rube for watching this thing. But it was awesome.
No, I'm still. I've said it a few times now to different guests, but it's true. I'm still through. I'm still in the second run of it. I haven't finished the second.
You're watching the whole thing twice?
Yeah, I'm watching it again because I found it, for me, it made me miss, oddly enough, it made me miss band practice. It made me miss being in a room with, because we're so separated now.
Me too, yeah.
I'm not even in a band actively right now, but I mean, I miss those dynamics. I miss the highs and lows of it, and I miss the ability to create with people like that. So, and yeah, I mean I've only done it on a, I've done it on a smaller scale than you have, certainly, but I mean, I miss it. And also, that's, you know, that band is my first love, so it's, I feel like that band did whatever it could in the face of unprecedented circumstances, fame, fortune, to humanize themselves constantly, just do things that made them seem, feel like normal people. And every time I've ever seen an interview, they're so matter-of-fact about stuff. You know, even when you watch like interviews in the 80s with Harrison and McCartney and Starr talking about John's murder, it's a, maybe a British trait, but they just speak about it in a very like plain-spoken, emotional but not way. And I think that's, they're just human. They're just dudes. And I think that's, I remember still as a kid, Rob, I was reading, I used to read every Beatles thing I had. And there was a section of an early tour where Ringo was sick. And so they had to have a sub drummer.
Really?
And I remember reading that. Yeah, it was like after they were really big. Ringo had like a stomach flu, I believe, or something like that. And he couldn't play a couple shows. And I remember reading that being like, these guys are just people. Like as a kid realizing like you can get the stomach flu if you're in the Beatles. Like how is that possible? Yeah. Like I just didn't occur to me. They were so iconic. So
well, what's fascinating about the Beatles, I mean, I'm not like a Beatles head, but I certainly know their stuff inside out, like just through, you know. I mean, I do love the Beatles. I mean, there's sort of lots to hate too. But what's great about them is if you're at all interested in rock and roll music, and certainly like rock and roll in terms of it being a band thing, that they did everything first. You know, like they so that's one of the reasons why they come across as genuine, is because they are genuine, because they're not following stock moves that we all know.
That's true.
Rock and roll. I thought about this years ago when that. Also embarrassed that I watched that like 3-hour Eagles documentary that was out. And I don't like the Eagles, but I watched it and it really struck me how like these guys are like second generation rock stars. Like they saw what, maybe it's third generation, maybe if, I mean, I don't know how we define these things, but like,
well, they're taking 50s, 60s, 70s. So they're in the '70s, right? So yeah,
the way they're getting off their private jet and the way that they're behaving backstage is they're following moves that are established but not super cliched yet. Like they're not Spinal Tap yet, but they're starting to become Spinal Tap.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Beatles don't really have any of that because they're doing something that no one had done before.
Right. You know? That's a good point.
And so like, you know, if you sit and listen to band people talk, especially, and like I have a lot in my life, it's like people in bands are fucking insufferable because the way they talk about their bands, they're so stock and so cliched, and the people talk about like their fan base or their, you know, like their fucking haircuts, you know, or their gear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, it's just so boring because it's so stock and cliched. Whereas, you know, like, yeah, something like the Beatles or like, you know, think of someone like Jimi Hendrix. I mean, you listen to Jimi Hendrix. I was listening to Band of Gypsies yesterday, and part of me was like, oh, this guitar playing is incredible and kind of disgusting because it's been ruined by decades of people doing the same pentatonic.
Copying it,
you know,
yeah.
Wailing, yeah. But it was new then, you know, and I'm not saying anything original. I mean, this is, but it's just, that's what's so cool about watching the Beatles in the studios. And, yeah, and that creative process, I think they should show that to like in offices or something, just like how do people interact when you have to create something from scratch, creating music. Like it's so hard to, I mean, they're not really writing songs together, but they kind of are. But if you've ever had to like sit down with somebody from square one and make something together, it's really, really hard. I mean, I do a bit of screenwriting, and I have a guy I work with, Max, and we're like writing these things like from square one together. We rarely write apart. We write it together, and it's grueling.
Yeah,
but it's great.
Yeah, yeah,
and it's really satisfying.
Yeah,
and seeing them do that, it, like that's the part that's really. I mean, I love watching them play, and it's great. But watching how they communicate with one another, and kind of poorly, but I guess they've been together enough that they have a kind of telepathy that they don't.
Well,
have
they're
to
falling. They're following. They're falling apart. Like there was part of me that thought, man, imagine there was footage like this of them making Revolver. What would that have been like?
Yeah.
But they're making their one of their final records together, yeah. and they're falling apart. And yeah. I found it. I mean, and it was just fascinating seeing like Mal Evans suggest lyrics to Paul McCartney. You know, like their roadies, like, why don't you say standing instead of whatever, waiting?
Yeah.
You're just like, holy Lord. Like, but they were receptive to it. They weren't, they just seemed very human. They weren't like, what are you telling me how to, I'm a goddamn genius. Yeah. Why are you telling me how to write The Long and Winding Road, for crying out loud?
Yeah, it's because they weren't, their genius or whatever you want to call it, wasn't necessarily enshrined in public consciousness yet. They were just like, something like Paul McCartney, you can tell he's just a song and dance guy, you know, he's like melody guy. He just like, I get a melody and a couple, idea. I mean, they're full of themselves in many ways, but
yeah.
But they're not full of themselves in the way that, like, if we were listening to, like, I don't know, name some, like the Foo Fighters or something like that now, who are just like a bundle of cliches smashed together. It's like the Beatles were doing something, and like Paul McCartney is probably just thinking, how am I going to make the biggest hit I can make and the prettiest melody, you know? Like, and I don't mean to make it sound like he's an airhead. He's not thinking about his legacy quite yet. There's a few moments where they talk about it a little bit. Like, they sort of talk, and he makes a joke about, like, everyone's going to say the Beatles broke up because Yoko sat on an amp or something. And all of us are home are like, yep, that's what they, you know, that is what they,
that's what
they
happened. I was so prescient, I thought. Yeah. No, I think they're
smart. It was really
smart.
Fascinating, though, yeah.
I found it really fascinating. Speaking of archival footage, and I'll wrap us up here with a couple of things. But one of the things was, I recently was asked to participate in a book that someone's working on about Edgefest 95, which Thresh Hermit, you played at, obviously.
Right,
and anyway, I was also sent some footage. Someone filmed stuff on like a VHS or whatever recording machine, and some people filmed the whole day. And there's a weird thing where I was watching. I was there, so I was like, "Where? I wonder if I'll spot us." Me and my friends, and I'll tell you that there's a shot that occurs after Buck 65 and the local, Stinkin' Rich and the Local Rabbits have finished their side stage set, and there's a camera like that's panning the whole stage from like some vantage point, and it zooms in on me as a what was I at the time, 16, 17, almost 18 year old kid, and I'm leaving the stage. And it pans to follow me, leave. And I don't know why it chose me. The person chose me, but they just chose to follow me. And as I walk by...
You know why? Because you were the only not white person there, probably.
That was probably it, actually. I actually wondered if I was... It was almost I was maybe going to be assassinated, actually. It's almost Zapruder film-esque. Oh, but anyway, in the shot, as I'm leaving, finally, there's you and Ian McGettigan and Joel Plaskett.
Huh.
And I thought that was really weird that would occur. And I don't know what it means in the current parlance of our surveillance state, but it was really weird to not only spot myself, but like, holy shit, like the guy, whoever it was, the person, made a point of just for Falling action, you. Just like there's someone leaving, I assume. But to your point, it might have been like, what the hell's that guy up to? He's brown. You got to keep an eye on that guy. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you because I thought it was interesting. I don't have any particular point.
I heard about that book, and I don't know anything about it, but the only thought I had was, what... I guess we'll
find out. But I think the point, as you might imagine, if you can think back on that time, 1995, there was an underground rock explosion that occurred. Then the major figurehead of that explosion died. But I feel like 95 was the end of the...
You're talking about the singer for a Conline Crush. Right?
Yeah. He's gone. Oh, is he? That's a horrible... I don't... I hope he's fine.
I can't even remember it.
Anyway, I was referring to Kurt Cobain from the America.
Right.
I feel like there was a major label...
He was in Nirvana.
There was a major...
He wasn't in the band America.
That's right. He wasn't in a Conline Crush. He was in Nirvana. There was a major label, Feeding Frenzy, which Thresh Hermit was eaten by
fed
at one point, but I think we'll let the book speak for itself, but I think he's viewing that period as a turning point, because there was a Feeding Frenzy, but then things got very depressing, and then all the people who were eaten by the labels were mostly all dispatched shortly thereafter, and the scene, the Canadian music community started to kind of had to go lick its wounds before it kind of came back. So I think he's looking at that day as a major turning point. But again, I don't want to put, I might be wrong and the book might have changed focus, but that's, I think, the, because you're right. Like, why would someone write a book about a day, a festival, like a not a super well attended underground Canadian music festival? But at the same time, it was a pretty pivotal, it was a meaningful day to me. So I was happy to participate. Anyway, all this to say, Rob, I just wanted to broach that with you. I don't expect any commentary per se. You're not a nostalgic person. If people want to learn more about you and Bleeding Light, where would you like to send them?
Would you mind if I also shout? Which I thought the one of the things I thought we were going to talk about today was the soundtrack.
Oh, you should talk about the soundtrack. You did send me that soundtrack.
The soundtrack.
Yeah, there's the Bleeding Light soundtrack. Please do talk about the soundtrack because there's some rarities on there. Please, please.
Well, if people don't know how to read, they can also listen to a musical interpretation of the book by a bunch of my friends.
It's interesting because the book is not musical per se.
No, not really. No, there's not really any much music stuff in there.
Who's on the soundtrack of the book?
Oh, a bunch of people. Joel, our friend Joel Baskett. Who's also, I'd have to look at the list. There's Buck 65, who you mentioned, he's on there.
There's there's an outtake by Tons.
It's all unreleased stuff. Marcus Starling is on there, Ben Gunning, Pete Elkis. Basically just all my friends. Brendan from Broken Social Scenes on there.
Brendan Canning?
Yep. A band called Did You Die from Out West. A guy, A. Wallace from Out East is on there. Whack of people.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot. Where can people go to find that thing?
It's only a digital thing, so it's on Spotify or Bandcamp. bleedinglight.bandcamp.com. The proceeds, if any sales, I mean, you can stream it or download it if you buy it or put in any money. It goes to the Toronto Encampment Network, which is helping out some of the there's situation in Toronto, like everywhere, or not everywhere, but in many places getting a little dire with the housing situation. Yeah. So we were able to focus a little bit of money toward helping that. But it's kind of a sort of a soundtrack to the book. Kind of follows the sequence of the book, some of the moves of it. Some people wrote original songs based on the book, and others kind of just picked stuff that sort of fit the vibe.
Oh, nice.
But it's kind of a fun thing. And it turned out to be pretty awesome. It's pretty epic.
Yeah, I will. I think you sent me a kind of a private link to it, so I need to go buy it from the Bandcamp, and I'll do that right after we're done. And I'll link to that Bandcamp thing in the podcast description. So if you're listening, go read about this episode, and you will be able to click on the link to both pick up this book, Bleeding Light, which is out via Invisible Publishing, and also you can pick up the soundtrack via Bandcamp. So sorry I didn't bring that up, Rob. I forgot about it, but I appreciate you remembering and doing my job for me.
I should do your job for you.
Yeah, you should. By the way,
if you ever need a host to sub in,
it doesn't pay well. It doesn't pay well, this job, just so you know. It's just a labor of love. With some,
it also doesn't pay well.
Some generosity.
Writing books.
If we could go out on a song, since we talked about some music, why don't we go out on a song from the Bleeding Light soundtrack? Is that something we could do? Could you pick one? I know, I hate to put you on the spot.
No, I'm just, you know what? Song I love is the one by Marcus Starling. If you guys know Marker, Chris, it's called Whatever's Easy. He wrote a song, I think, exclusively for it. It was a a new thing that he did, and it turned out really, really well. And I like all the tunes on the soundtrack, but this one kind of hit me in a certain way. It's kind of mellow, kind of wistful.
Well, Marker Starling has been on this show. We are fans of the Marker Starling.
Yeah, that's great, dude.
What's the song that you've chosen?
It's called Whatever's Easy.
Whatever's Easy. Okay. All right. Should we go to it? Let's go to it now. This is Whatever's Easy by Marcus Starling. And this is from the soundtrack to this amazing new novel, Bleeding Light, by my guest, Rob Benvey. Rob, it's always a pleasure to speak with you in any context, and to have you back on the show is a pleasure and an honor. And I wish you the best luck with everything in the future.
Back at you, Vish. Back at you. All the exact same thing slammed back in your face. No, it's great. It's always great to talk to you. I love being on your show. I love your show. I love you.
Thanks.
This is great.
I love you too, Rob. Thank you.
gonna stay up till the break of dawn and party on. I want to yell and sing until my voice is nearly gone. Can't change my mind once I've made it up. In a double bind of my own making, I only wanna do whatever's easy.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks again to Rob Benvey for appearing on this, the 658th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever it is you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook if you like. You can also follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to help support and sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, and there will be some exclusive content with Rob Benvey. We did a little extra OT overtime feature, and so if you enjoyed this chat and you want a little bit more, again, go to patreon.com/creativecontrol. $6 or more grants you access to that content. And but you can always change it. If you signed up at $6, you can go lower. You can also go higher. And so whatever you want to do, it's your call, man. $6 or more, again, is good, but anything you want to do is fine. Patreon.com/creativecontrol. Also, while you're there, if you want a Creative Control t-shirt, please just message me on Patreon, and I will get you one while supplies last. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, each of which is located in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my pal, Jim Guthrie. He lets me use some music of his on this show, and you can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Rob Benvey, and for subscribing to this podcast and maybe telling your friends about the show, and maybe suggesting they do some of the same stuff you do. That would be great, just to help spread the word about the show. Otherwise, you don't even have to do any of that stuff, by the way. You can just chill out. It's fine. It's just, I just like to say that in case you didn't think of doing that. Oh, what if I tell my uncle and my aunt about the show? Maybe they'll subscribe and listen together. That's possible. Your uncle and aunt are hip. Anyway, I'll talk to you very soon. Be well. It's the end of December as I'm talking to you. I hope, I think, this is the last episode of the year. Happy New Year. See you in 2022. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.